Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 17th of April, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish.
We're going to begin with Theresa.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I do apologise straight away.
Talk of the British. Sorry.
Yes. She was giving her her statement to the House of Commons yesterday over the attack on Syria. And she said it was legally and morally right for the UK to join airstrikes against Syria to prevent further human suffering. She said there was clear evidence that Assad's government was behind the chemical weapons attack in Douma. We'll let that pass for a second. UK medical experts apparently have analysed open source reports, images and video footage. That means they've been looking at Twitter, as we mentioned yesterday. But she admitted this yesterday. And she said that, furthermore, Mr. Speaker, the Syrian regime has reportedly been attempting to conceal the evidence by searching evacuees from Douma to ensure samples are not being smuggled from this area. Look, what's going on here? Terrorists are being allowed to leave the area, and they are being allowed to leave the area under certain terms and with certain quantities of weapons. Of course, they're being searched on the way out. Brian, this is obvious. It's got nothing to do with concern about that they might be smuggling chemical weapons samples on the way. But anyway, she went on and said a wider operation to conceal the facts of the attack is underway, supported by the Russians. Of course it is. Even if the OPCW team is able to visit Douma to gather information to make that the assessment, and they're currently being prevented from doing so by the regime and the Russians, it cannot attribute responsibility. Well, at exactly the same time that she was making that statement, the OPCW was making their own statement, and they made it quite clear that the reason that OPCW staff were not able to get to the actual site in Douma was for security reasons. And the security reasons, by the way, were mainly caused by the fact that originally the US, the UK and France were bombing the place or close by. And then, of course, yesterday there was an incident involving Israel. So there were security reasons why these people couldn't go out to play in Douma yesterday. And she said, however, the UK had explored every diplomatic channel in response, but regrettably decided there was no alternative to a limited, carefully targeted action.
Can I just say that, Mike, this statement that you've got on screen, I just find fascinating. Reportedly been attempting to conceal the evidence. So the suggestion is that the evidence is so small that a few people might be able to take all of the evidence out the area.
Well, it's pathetic.
Yeah.
So what did Jeremy Corbyn do? Well, he actually asked some pretty sensible questions, similar questions to he had in his letter that we covered yesterday. He said that the action was legally questionable. He said that the Attorney General had given clear legal advice, but he wanted to see it. So would she publish it? Of course she didn't. He said that given that neither the United Nations or the OPCW had investigated, it's clear that diplomatic and non-military means had not been fully exhausted. He called once again for the OPCW to get to their work, and he suggested that the UK should continue pursuing diplomatic means. But I have to say she was largely let off the hook, even by Jeremy Corbyn, because, of course, he didn't mention the elephant in the room, which is this. And that is that in the coalition government from 2010 to 2015, while Theresa May was Home Secretary, her colleague William Hague claimed that he was working extremely hard to enshrine in law for the future the necessity of consulting Parliament and military action. And I'm not aware that anybody in this debate yesterday asked why this work had not been completed. It's really unfortunate that she was in government at the time. But it's now inconvenient. So this was in March 2011. The government had acknowledged, apparently, that a convention had developed that the House of Commons should have the opportunity to debate conflict decisions before troops were committed abroad, except when there's an emergency and this would not be possible. Well, this was not the case in this case. And William Hague, who was the Foreign Secretary at the time, said that he would enshrine this in law. Then the Political and Constitutional Reform Committee produced five reports which welcomed at the time government commitment to formalising the role. Well, as quick as a flash, nothing has happened since. So she was pretty much let off the hook on that one, unfortunately. And the other thing the other mistake that Corbyn made, if we could call it that, was that he made a quip about Theresa May sort of doing the bidding of the US Trump. President. I think anybody that's been watching this scenario as it's unfolded has seen quite clearly that the driver for it has been Britain, the Foreign Office, and Theresa May, and she has encouraged Trump and Macron to get involved. It's not that Trump has been leading this. He certainly hasn't.
No, and of course we've got the Salisbury fracas at the back of it as well, Mike, haven't we? So yeah,
we'll be coming on to that. Now, Craig Murray had some stuff to say about the legal justification for bombing. Because although they won't publish the Attorney General's advice, they have published a briefing paper. So he's commenting on that. He says it specifically claims, as customary international law practices, which are rejected by a large majority of states and therefore cannot be customary international law. It does not quote the UN Charter, any Security Council resolution, or any international treaty or agreement of any kind which justifies the action. This is because there's absolutely nothing which can be quoted. All the relevant texts say that an attack on another state is illegal without authorization of the UN Security Council under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. And Brian, this brings me back to the point that I'm going to make once again, that if we listen to the language of Theresa May and Boris Johnson, particularly over the last year or two, international law, the principle of international law, the term international law, is increasingly sidelined, and we're getting words like international order, rules-based international order,
consensus.
The rules, consensus, yeah. Norm, international norms, and these types of words. This is a very dangerous trajectory that we're treading at the moment, and yeah. You know, we need to get back to the principles of international law, really, don't we?
Proper international law.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, the BBC yesterday had Admiral Alan West, is it Alan West?
Alan West, yeah.
Yes. On, and well, I'm going to comment on the BBC here, but in order to set the context, we need to sort of get a feeling for what Alan West said. So let's have a listen to this.
Yes, President Assad is in the process of winning this civil war, and he was about to take over and occupy Douma, all that area. He'd had a long, long, hard slog, slowly capturing that whole area of the city. And there, just before he goes in and takes it all over, apparently he decides to have a chemical attack. It just doesn't ring true. It seems extraordinary because clearly he would know that there's likely to be a response from the Allies. What benefit is there for his military? Most of the rebel fighters, this disparate group of Islamists, had withdrawn. There were a few women and children left around. What benefit was there militarily in doing what he did? I find that extraordinary. Whereas we know that in the past some of the Islamic groups have used chemicals, and of course there would be huge benefit in them labelling an attack as coming from Assad. Although we do know that the reports that came from there were from the White Helmets, who, let's face it, are not neutrals. You know, they're very much on the side of the disparate groups who are fighting Assad, and also the World Health Organization doctors who are there. And again, those doctors are embedded in amongst the groups, doing fantastic work, I know, but they're not neutral.
So that's a couple of short excerpts from the interview with Alan West, and it's good to see an establishment figure raising these concerns.
I think it's quite extraordinary, Mike, because many people would say that Admiral West has not been at his best in speaking out on some matters of international politics. But here he's going into this in quite some detail. What reason would Assad have for doing this when he was already winning the war? That's a very powerful question, and one which certainly the BBC itself doesn't want to ask. Why would he do it? And of course, he's also here pointing a finger at the White Helmets and saying very clearly these people are not impartial. They're working with, well, probably he would say the rebel movement. We would say actually these are partly Western-sponsored terrorists. but he's pointing it out.
Absolutely. Now, the BBC wasn't terribly impressed by that. Let's see what they had to say to him then.
We know that the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, said on Friday, or accused a Western state on Friday of perhaps fabricating evidence in Duma or somehow being involved with what happened in Duma. Given that we're in an information war with Russia on so many fronts, do you think perhaps it's inadvisable to be stating this so publicly, given your position and your profile? Isn't there a danger that you're muddying the waters?
So I think we're getting a clear insight there into the mindset of the BBC. The question in my mind is, have BBC journalists been briefed to the effect that we are in an information war with the Russians? And therefore, if we say anything which is beyond the government narrative, that we're playing into the hands of the Russians? Is that what they've been told?
That's exactly what they've been told, Mike. And of course, as we, many other people have said over a very long time, the BBC is just part of the British government's propaganda machine. So the British public hasn't been told that there's an information war going on. The term war, I think, is very significant. We're now not talking about a few bombs on Syria. That's how the government likes to think about it. It's just a few air-launched weapons. Now the BBC is telling us essentially we're at war. But no debate in Westminster. The British public not told. This is immensely dangerous stuff.
Well, absolutely. And of course, as they're saying in the chat box, it's not we that are at war. It's the BBC. It's the mainstream media. It's not the rest of us. But we mentioned a little video clip that the BBC produced, a couple of minutes of absolutely egregious propaganda over what happened at the weekend. And if you remember, the second half of it included a little piece of music. It had James Mattis on it, and then it went into various Twitter quotes and so on. I'm not going to play the music again because, well, surprisingly enough, Brian, we got a copyright strike on that on the YouTube feed, as you can see at the bottom there. It turns out that the music that they chose to show the next steps, as it were, was a piece of music called War Plan. I don't believe that was coincidental. They absolutely chose a piece of music which would instill, the ideas of war and emotion into people.
Yeah, it was very dark, emotive music, which was clearly designed to have a psychological effect on the audience actually looking at the rest of the material.
Yes. Now, another day, another attack. Of course, over the weekend, we had the front page Times expose in inverted commas of Piers Robinson, Tim Hayward and Vanessa Bailey. Front page article plus four articles inside plus an editorial. Well, now the BBC's getting in on it as well. And here's Michael Wendling, who contacted Vanessa Bailey this morning and said, "Dear Ms. Bailey, my team is currently preparing a report on influential social media commentators on the Syrian conflict and recent alleged chemical weapons attack to be published on the BBC News website. Your Twitter account has been identified as a key influencer on Twitter. I'm obliged to give you a further chance to comment and the opportunity to answer some questions and give some contact details." So let's see what the questions are. "Do you believe that the alleged chemical attack in Duma was staged, a false flag event, or even faked? Same question re the chemical attack in Khan Shaykhun on April 2017. Would you describe yourself as a, quotes, independent journalist? Are you in favour of the current military action being carried out by the Syrian government and its allies? In a report, the Syrian campaign stated that you have publicly called for white helmets to be considered legitimate military targets seven times, that you're prepared, you're part of a coordinated disinformation campaign, and that you described a meeting with President Bashar al-Assad as your proudest moment. Are these statements true? According to the website Media Bias / Fact Check, 21st Century Wire publishes conspiracy theories and pseudoscientific stories. Do you have a response to this analysis? Have you or 21st Century Wire received funding for your work from the Syrian government or its allies? We plan to publish this story tomorrow, apparently on the BBC website, BBC News website. So if you could get back to him by the end of the day, it'd be much appreciated. So those are the questions. That is the guy, Mike Wendling. And Well, I'm not really sure what else to say about that.
Well, I think we should encourage people to, if you have concerns about the way the BBC is handling this, which is essentially this man is saying there is going to be a hit piece, that's the way the whole thing is phrased. If, as a BBC licence payer, you have concerns about the way this man is doing his business, then I think freeze the frame, have a look at his telephone number, give him a call, and tell him what your personal opinions are about what's happening in Syria and, of course, the propaganda put out by the government. And the more polite people are, the more reasonable they are in making a telephone call, the more effect they're going to have. But these stories are put together by journalists. It isn't just the BBC as a machine produces a story. It's an individual journalist or a team of journalists. And they need to be challenged because at the moment they simply follow the British government line. So I'd encourage people to pick up the phone and speak to Mike Wendling and see what he has to say for himself.
Yesterday, Brian, we talked about this article, but I'm glad to say you have some comments as well.
Well, I do, Mike. I picked up this Express story. I found it very interesting because, of course, from a military perspective, we've got what everybody has known for ages, that if you have a fleet of nuclear submarines alone, you've got problems because conventional submarines, we'll loosely say battery-powered submarines, are immensely quiet, and in certain waters they have a huge advantage over nuclear submarines. We knew this, the Royal Navy knew it, but the MOD decided many years ago to scrap all Britain's conventional submarines, and many submariners said at the time, this is just crass, this is amazing stuff. So what was the story? That two Russian Kilo class conventional submarines had been harassing one of the latest Astute submarines to the extent that it appears it couldn't carry out its mission, which I found very interesting from my own background and experience in the anti-submarine field. But what I picked up is this comment in the middle of the article. A gentleman called Nick Childs from the International Institute for Strategic Studies said, submarine commanders were trained not to give away their position by firing too many missiles at once. And I was just astonished at this, because this is something out of Enid Blyton, I think, because the moment a submarine fires a missile, it's like putting up a huge rocket saying, here I am. Mm. So it's not a question of firing too many. The moment you fire one, you give your position away, and you've got to be pretty sure that the moment you've fired, you can vacate the area. So I thought, well, what sort of person would make this comment, and why would it be picked up in the Express? Well, if you go to the International Institute of Strategic Studies, you can find a little CV for Nick Childs. And what you find is that his whole experience to do with maritime naval matters appears to come from a period of 2002 and 2015 when he was a BBC reporter. So this man is put forward in the article as though he's a man of substance and experience. But when you actually go and look at him, you're going round in a circle because you're coming back to a BBC reporter who clearly on this subject doesn't know what he's talking about.
So this is a think tank.
This is a think tank, and we're going to have a little look at it because I think people should know what sort of a think tank it is. Went to have a look at his Twitter. Well, he's done three tweets, unless I've got the wrong page. So he's not too hot on tweeting. He's not too hot on describing submarine warfare. Here's the International Institute of Strategic Studies. It says they were set up, what's the date there, 1958, I think it was. And basically, they want to cut down on nuclear weapons. But we say very quickly, who are they? Yes, it said it was founded in the UK in 1958 with a focus on nuclear deterrence and arms control. It's also renowned now for the military balance. So who exactly is this organisation? Well, let's have a look at some of the people here, because we've got an amazing mix of bankers, military people, and what I've called the great and good. So I've just chosen some of them. We've got Joanda Assis. She's a senior advisor for Morgan Stanley. So we've got a nice big international bank. We're bringing this person here, Fleur de Villiers, former journalist and public affairs expert, career with Argus Group of newspapers, travelling correspondent for the Sunday Times. So very interesting, isn't it, that we had the hit piece from the Times. We get into this organisation, we go round in a circle, we're back to the BBC, we're back to the Times. We've got this gentleman here who appears to be big in oil, president of Crescent Petroleum, CEO of Crescent Enterprises, banks and big business. But then, oh my goodness, all of a sudden, we've got ex-British senior military people, Field Marshal, the Lord Guthrie of Cradibank, Colonel of the Life Guards, Gold Stick to the Queen, Colonel Commandant of the SAS, and he just happens to be a non-executive director of MN Rothschild & Sons Limited. So what is the agenda here? These people are clearly influencing government policy, but who are they and what's their real agenda? And when I found Lord Robertson here, former Secretary General of NATO, I really started to ask some questions about what this team is about. The Express doesn't identify who Mr. Charles really was or what this organisation is doing. The BBC uses this organisation to comment, but of course they never delve into it to say who are these people and what's the real agenda. Encourage our viewers and listeners to get online and have a look at that organisation and the individuals concerned themselves, because there are many more people, too many people to cover in today's news.
OK, a reminder of Media on Trial taking place in Leeds, 27th of May. Details on the media on mediaontrial.uk, that is the website. Tickets for £10. Do get along to that if you possibly can. It's a pretty important event in the light of what we've been covering over the last couple of weeks. Now, yesterday, the delightful Karen Pearce was once again speaking in the United Nations, and this time talking about sexual violence at a time in a time of conflict, and how they're working so hard to stop sexual violence in a time of conflict. And honestly, Brian, I just very quickly wanted to say once again, why is there all the focus on preventing one particular aspect of conflict, which is sexual violence against women, particularly women and girls? Why aren't we preventing the conflict in the first place?
Which would stop all of the problems.
Correct.
It would stop men and women being killed or having their legs blown off, all of those things. I think it's because the underlying agenda is division between men and women, and this is another banner that you can start to get tension between the sexes. So I think this is a very cold, callous exercise that is running much deeper than what it appears to be doing, protecting people from violence in war. Okay, well, on the subject of violence against persons, we'll come on to the subject of child abuse. This was sent through to us, and it's a tweet by the barrister Barbara Hewson. Quite an extraordinary, very, very aggressive tweet, which is attacking Alexis Jay, the head of the Independent Child Abuse Inquiry. So it says here, meanwhile, Alexis Jay is obviously unhinged, or her diary organisers are catatonically stupid. And the reason that Miss Hewson's got her underwear in something of a twist is because Alexis Jay has been at a conference which has been dealing with people who've been very badly abused in a ritualistic sense. And she took the decision to speak at the annual conference of the European Society for Trauma and Dissociation in Bern, Switzerland in November. The annual get-together is for devotees of the dissociative identity disorder, formerly multiple personality disorder. This is the highly contentious school of therapy which claims victims develop split personalities. So this is a very, very hard tweet, and of course it's also saying, well, I don't really believe what victims say when they come forward and say what has happened to them. Classic case of that, of course, is the horrific abuse of those two young children in Hampstead. But let's follow this through and remind people this was a Channel 4 interview of Barbara Hewson. As it says, it was an interview over her controversial child sex abuse comments. And this is going back to 2013. And if you go and listen to this or watch this little clip, you'll see that Barbara Hewson comes in and she starts laughing and she says that satanic ritual abuse doesn't exist. It's like alien abduction. And I think the interviewer there was quite shocked at the fact she started sniggering at this when, of course, so many victims come forward to talk about horrific abuse under these circumstances. She says it doesn't exist. I've just put up one example of a conviction of satanic abuse, horrific abuse of young children. This took place in South Wales. But we've got a practicing barrister who doesn't seem to know what the reality is. Why would she deny what is evidenced in the public domain, Mike?
And even within her own profession?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good question.
It is a good question. So we thought we'd follow through. Let's remind ourselves that, of course, it was the BBC that reported that a Satanist had been allowed to practice on board a warship. This is what the spokesman for the Royal Navy said. We are an equal opportunities employer and we don't stop anybody from having their own religious values. So there we are, absolutely clear that the Royal Navy, part of Britain's defence structure, said that you can be a Satanist, that's fine, as long as you don't do anything which would cause our operations problems. Well, this gets more interesting because somebody kindly drew my attention to this document, which was a Freedom of Information request that was put forward to the Ministry of Defence. And let's have a look at what they say. So here we are. It says, request for information. Thank you for your email dated Saturday, the 17th of December, 2015, requesting the following information. Please supply all documentation which relates to the recent approval of Satanism and or Luciferianism as a religion or form of worship, valid religion for use on Royal Navy vessels. Please ensure that the names are included, identifying all public officials who were instrumental responsible in the issuing and instigation of the decision to permit this religion's use on board Navy vessels when the policy was instigated and any policy documents. If the decision was not specific to the Royal Navy but relates to any or all armed forces in the UK, then please supply the relevant documentation for this as an alternative to the specific request above. So the reply is that it's treated as a request for information under the Freedom of Information Act 2000. And this is the reply. I can confirm that no approval of Satanism, Luciferianism as a religion has been issued by the Royal Navy. The armed forces regard personal beliefs as a private matter, and what is done in his individual's own time is also regarded as a private matter, as long as it does not offend others, affect operational effectiveness, or create an adverse impact on the reputation of the armed forces. However, we do not recognise Satanism as a formal religion, and we will not grant facilities or make specific time available for individual worship. So are we saying here, Mike, that the BBC pushed out a fake article?
They couldn't have.
Well, I'm going to say we know they didn't because we followed the story through at the time. And what we discovered is that it was absolutely true that this man had been allowed to practice Satanism on board the warship. And he'd later been promoted into a job in the Ministry of Defence, where it was still accepted that he was a Satanist. Just for completeness, here is the end of that reply so that we can be sure we are putting up the real document. So it ends as would be normal. No signature, of course, but it's come from the Navy Command Secretariat Freedom of Information section. So we seem to have got a bit of a split personality with the Royal Navy there. They've approved it for use on board the warship, except when you ask whether they've done that, and then they simply deny it. Interesting. Well, somebody who's very interesting in how children are being abused in this way has also followed through the fact that the trail of this type of abuse takes us through the family courts. And on the screen is a letter that was sent to Sir James Mumby asking him about this subject. It's dated the 5th of March. I'll just read it out very quickly. It says, open letter, Satanism in the judiciary. I understand that without the matter ever having been put before the electorate, Satanism now enjoys legal status as a religion and may be practiced, e.g. on board Navy vessels. Presumably then it's held to be equally acceptable in all our institutions. Those who have grown up in the families of practicing Satanists give clear evidence that the ceremonies and practices involved are not as innocent as sometimes claimed, and that the abuse, rape and even murder of children are frequently involved. Their testimony is confirmed by the fact that Satanists have appeared before British courts and have indeed been convicted of perpetrating such crimes in connection with their religion. In view of the fact that these people frequently operate outside of the law, are you able to confirm A, that no judge currently officiating in the family courts is a Satanist, and B, that no Satanist will at any future date be permitted to enter the ranks of the family court judiciary? If you're unable to give me an assurance on both these points, I must assume that there are indeed Satanists already officiating in the family court, and that more of the same are likely to join them as new appointments are made. So that was sent to Judge Mumby, and this is the reply that was received. So this is dated the 27th of March. Dear Miss S, I am writing in response to your letter, which was received by this office on the 6th of March 2018, addressed to Sir James Mumby, President of the Family Division. The President has seen your letter and has no comment. And you notice there, Mike, that there's no signature. It simply says for Sir James Mumby, President's Chambers. So this was a pretty important letter on some immensely serious matter. Mumby could have replied himself. It could have a signature so that we can be sure he's actually seen the letter. Did he see the letter that was sent in to him? Mm. We've no way of knowing. But I'm going to say, there's a picture of Mr. Mumby, if you're not aware of what he looks like. But the person who wrote the letter responded, and we'll leave this one on screen. You can freeze it and read the detail. But it says, I'm in receipt of the unsigned letter from the President's Chambers written on your behalf. In my letter, I express concern at official recognition of Satanism. You will understand that the lack of a straight answer to my questions can only increase my concern that there are indeed judges who are practicing Satanists. So under the circumstances, please would you assure me that where one parent is alleged by the other to have sexually assaulted or raped their child, the religion of the officiating judge will be made known and the parent making the allegations permitting to demand the replacement of a Satanist with someone more suitable. So, remarkable state of affairs. We've got the Ministry of Defence appearing to get confused at best, lying at worst over its policy on Satanism, and we get a total silence from the head of the Family Law Division, even though there are child abuse cases going through the Family Division courts, which involved the abuse of children under ritualistic conditions. So a surprising silence there.
Mm. Right. Well, yesterday began. It was the beginning of the heads of government meeting for the Commonwealth. And there was Baroness Scotland giving her some opening remarks. Martin Luther King, she said, famously said, I have a dream and we too have dreams across a common future. So that's what the Commonwealth is all about, building a common future. So as a prequel to the heads of government meeting, Theresa May spoke at the Guildhall in the City of London to members of the Commonwealth Business Forum. This is just one of four such four running this week ahead of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, giving a voice to hundreds of people who, in so many different ways, are so much make so much of our Commonwealth the amazing institution that it is. There's a People's Forum, including a platform for the Commonwealth's incredible civil society groups. There's a Women's Forum, which is going to look at ways of overcoming the challenges still faced by many women and girls. And there's a Commonwealth Youth Forum as well as the Business Forum. But the main focus for her speech was on trade, and she said the 2018 Commonwealth Trade Review predicted that trade between member states would be worth £700 billion by 2020. She said if Commonwealth businesses are to flourish in such times, if we are to deliver and secure the prosperous future our young people want and deserve, then the Commonwealth and national governments must not be afraid to act. And so what's she talking about? Well, the UK is going to be funding a Commonwealth Standards Network, which is going to make sure that all up-and-coming third world countries that happen to be Commonwealth nations are committed to international trading standards, international trading norms, if you want to call it that, free trade. She's going to work hand in hand with businesses to make sure that that they do make use of these international trading standards. The UK will be funding an all-new Commonwealth Standards Network, as I say. It's going to be funding a trade facilitation programme, supporting and providing technical assistance to selected Commonwealth countries in implementing the World Trade Organization's Trade Facilitation Agreement. Now, this is quite interesting because the Trade Facilitation Agreement contains provisions for effectively making it easier to move goods, to clear goods through customs, including goods in transit. It sets out measures for effective cooperation between customs and other appropriate authorities on trade facilitation and customs compliance issues. Does that not sound a bit like a single market, Brian, a customs union? This is pretty much it. So this is where they're heading towards, the Commonwealth replicating what the European Union has done with the single market and the customs union. The trade facilitation agreement, by the way, also offers enforceability of the rules through a dispute resolution mechanism, very much like we're heading to, or we've been heading towards with the likes of TTIP and so on. Over the next 2 years, she said the UK is going to work with the International Trade Centre to deliver a new programme called She Trades Commonwealth. So She Trades will offer Commonwealth-wide support to help countries break down gender barriers in international trade, and will compile all the data that we need to identify what works and what doesn't over time. So that's fantastic. That's what she was talking about this morning. And in the meantime then, Amber Rudd has announced a new dedicated team of people that are going to work from inside the Home Office to help any Commonwealth individual identify and gather evidence to confirm whether they have a right to reside in the United Kingdom. This team is going to include a dedicated contact point and aim to resolve cases within 2 weeks once the evidence has been put together. No one's going to be charged for this service. It's quite amazing. Commonwealth getting some pretty special treatment here. As we've mentioned many times, the British government's position is, or the question that they have, is what is the best route towards global governance structures? Is it through the United Nations or is it through the Commonwealth? Well, they're becoming increasingly frustrated with the United Nations as a result of vetoes from Russia and China. It looks like they have shifted their focus absolutely 100% onto the Commonwealth now.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's remind people, Saturday the 12th of May, Dying for Good Health, our conference on the NHS. We are getting a very good response. People are buying tickets. That is excellent. If you haven't bought a ticket yet, please get online and purchase one. And also do help us to spread this conference around. So many people have talked to us about things going on in the NHS. We've been talking to doctors and nurses. We've been talking to managers. We've been talking to patients themselves and relatives who have all got experiences of what is going on inside the NHS. Of course, many people saying that the Conservatives are very close to privatising the NHS, and yet none of the true facts are coming out in the famous mainstream media. So this will be a really unique conference, and do get along and have a look. And I'm also going to say, for people that want to do something, you know something's wrong, but you're asking yourself, what can you do about it? Then you might like to get along to the New Chartist Movement meeting. The British Constitution Group has been helping this movement start. It's very simple. It's very clear cut. It's totally inclusive. But if you're a person who are concerned about what's happening in UK and you want to do something about it, you might like to get along to that meeting on Thursday in Manchester, and there will be more meetings throughout the country.
Now, let's move on to Skripal. Yesterday we mentioned that Sergei Lavrov had been making a statement regarding the nature of the chemical agent, the toxic chemical used to poison the Skripals. And Lavrov said the analysis of the samples uncovered traces of the toxic chemical BZ and its precursors falling into the second category of chemical weapons under the Chemical Weapons Convention. That was over the last day or two. Some of the mainstream media, including the Daily Mail, have hit back with news today that officials have revealed that Novichok nerve agent that poisoned former Russian spy and his daughter was delivered in a liquid form, and they're claiming that 9 sites in Salisbury are still potentially contaminated, Brian, with Novichok. So I'd say you probably need to evacuate that city as quickly as possible.
Well, apparently not, because they've washed their clothes, and the clothes that didn't need washing they've sent to the dry cleaners, and that's the problem solved.
Okay, so the Mail this morning said that Skripal and his daughter were both poisoned with Novichok. They've made that statement. It's not a question, it's a statement. They were both in hospital, and traces of the nerve agent were found on his door. And they say that the government has today said the nerve agent was delivered in a liquid form. Well, this whole story gets stranger and stranger, so let's have a look at why. Because Lavrov saying that the toxic chemical used was BZ, and he had received this information from a Swiss toxicology lab. So the story was originally broken about the Swiss lab by Associated Press and also by Modern Diplomacy with this article. Swiss governmental lab identifies the substance used on the Skripal case as being linked to NATO. So this, as I say, Associated Press broke the story originally. This article was written by Dr. Andrea Galli, who runs or ran an organization called Scholaris Economic Crime Analysis. It seems to be a private intelligence gathering organization, particularly with regard to forensic financial crime. It's a serious operation. He is most recently associated with an organization called Swiss East Affairs, which is a Swiss-based company, which they say highly specializes in solving complex affairs in the Eastern Hemisphere, particularly in combating and preventing economic and financial crimes, providing specialized intelligence and consulting services to our clients for their affairs, their issues and their emergencies and so on. But anyway, the point is, what does this article say? It says that the Swiss Institute for NBC Protection, so this is Protection of Nuclear, Biological, Chemical Weapons and Spies. It's a world-renowned Swiss government-run center of excellence in forensic analysis of weapons of mass destruction. Here is their website. And as you can see there, their vision, they say, is a world without weapons of mass destruction. Galli in his article says that the Swiss lab reported that the poison found in Salisbury by OPCW investigators looking into the Skripal affair, that there were traces of the toxic agent BZ, as well as traces of A234. So there seemed to be some kind of a confusion here, or some kind of mix between the two, which is all very strange. This is in the toxic samples that were given to the OPCW by Porton Down. But what he's saying is that the presence of BZ explains the clinical description of what happened to the Skripals. In other words, a delayed reaction, hallucinations, strange stuff like that. Okay, so he says that BZ was developed and weaponized in the 1960s as a new chemical agent for the battlefield, as a psychochemical and assigned to NATO code agent BZ. It's a nerve poisoning agent and a chemical weapon that is non-lethal but causes a wide variety of potentially incapacitating symptoms in its victims. Soldiers can become disoriented and even experience hallucinations. He said less than 1 milligram of BZ takes 30 to 60 minutes to act and can produce acute brain syndrome, characterized by delirium lasting for 3 to 5 days, which can be reversed through drugs. It is a hallucinogenic agent, and it's in a class of chemicals which consistently produce changes in thought, perception and mood. And one of the other substances in this class of chemicals is LSD, right? So this is in the Galli article, but it gets strange because, well, the Galli article has been taken offline. So that was a couple of days ago, that original screen shot was taken, but it's now been taken offline. I wrote to him and I asked him why has it been taken offline. He said it has been removed because of a complaint from the Spears laboratory, officially because of the use of copyright material, meaning the picture that was used in the original article. They contacted the website Modern Diplomacy, threatening severe legal action if the article wasn't taken down. And he says if it was a pretext or not, I can only speculate. But that's not all that was going on, because then the lab itself has pushed out this tweet. Only OPCW can comment on Lavrov's assertion about the use of BZ, but we can repeat what we stated 10 days ago. We have no doubt that Portendown has identified Novichok. However, in response to that, somebody posted, "You're in the best position to say what your findings were, not OPCW, basically. Answering that you have no doubt that Portendown has identified Novichok is like answering a question with a riddle. What the world needs is a straightforward response." And they then responded, "No, we're not in the best position. The OPCW has rejected Russia demands to publish the designated labs involved. Wait for a meeting of the OPCW Executive Council on the 18th. So perhaps we'll get our answers tomorrow. But Brian, this gets weirder and weirder, with articles being pulled offline through threats. But they have at no point have they denied that they made the statement that BZ was involved in this.
Yeah, and well, we just come back to the beginning very quickly. Nothing about the Skripal incident in Salisbury makes any sense. It doesn't make sense that it was a military-grade nerve agent because of what the reaction of the Skripals were. We haven't had any evidence. We haven't seen any chemical formula. And now we've got something else coming forward that seems to fit the bill. But who was responsible for creating that agent? Well, it was the US and UK. So Alan West said in the video we saw a little bit earlier that the Russians lie. Well, I think what's becoming ever more clear is that we've got the British government lying and hiding the truth at the same time. So we've got to keep pushing.
Yeah, I mean, what's absolutely clear, just as a final comment, is that there's obviously a lot of pressure being put on some people behind the scenes here. The fact that the OPCW are simply not stating categorically that it was Novichok, they've refused to publicly identify the agent used, that they're saying that they're only giving this information to the members of the OPCW. Why, if it's simply clear cut that it was Novichok, and they've identified which particular version of Novichok it was, why don't they simply give us the proper designation for what the chemical agent was? Seems like a simple thing to do.
Yeah, should be. What have we got here? Right, we'll do this very quickly, but this caught my attention. It's an article from a couple of months ago saying that the Met Office had lost its contract with the BBC for weather information. And the little inset quote here was by the chief executive of the Met Office. He said, "Not good enough, it seems, for the BBC. Obviously, we were disappointed. The Met Office's bespoke BBC service included data, meteorologists, forecasters and presenters and graphics. Meteor Group is a service provider that relies on the national Met agencies to provide the data, taking data from a range of sources, some of which will be ours, i.e. the Met Office, and serving it to the BBC in the way the BBC wants them to. I don't really see the public will notice a great deal of difference." So the BBC's taken a contract worth £3 million away from the Met Office, and they've given it to the Meteor Group on the basis that this is going to help the forecasting and better standards for the viewer. But the Met Office saying, well, hang on a minute, because it's going to be our data anyway, or much of it. So this was the BBC crowing about the change of their weather programme, and we can trust it much more, and it's going to be glossier with more colour pictures, presumably. And here's Meteor Group, BBC weather contract awarded to Meteor Group. Fascinating organisation, because when you get into them, you see down the bottom here that they're partnered by a huge hedge fund called General Atlantic. And if we get into that hedge fund, they're handling $24 billion in assets. And my question is, look at these men and women. This is just some of them. There are many more than the pictures on screen. We've got essentially very powerful international monetary people handling billions of dollars are suddenly very interested in the weather. And if I just come back to this one here, I've entitled it Meet the Global Weather Authority. Well, that's what Meteor Group say underneath their head logo, top left, Meteor Group. It says in the small text underneath, the Global Weather Authority. But when we see who's behind it, we're back into huge hedge funds.
But we're building global institutions here.
We're building global institutions. And of course, the BBC is absolutely in bed with them. Okay.
Right. We'll just end with a reminder of AV9. All the rooms booked. So day tickets only available at this point, 4th to the 7th of May 2018, Horward House Hotel near Milton Keynes. Details at alternativeview.co.uk.
Excellent. And we'll just say that we've had a couple of sources, I have to use that expression, saying to us that Rolls-Royce is going to cut 30% of its management jobs. Now, if this is correct, this means that there must be some very suspect things going on inside that company and the performance of that company. So today's Tuesday, the 17th of April, we're simply repeating what we've been told. Big cuts in Rolls-Royce management. Let's wait and see whether that finally hits the wonderful mainstream media. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.